Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
We'll certainly finish unequal cell sizes. Then we may get on to, we will get on to simple regression. I don't think we'll finish simple regression, but we'll get on to it. So most designs for analysis of variance assume equal n's. The math works better with equal n's. If you note the number of times you saw that n was a, one of the terms of when you're actually doing the sums of squares, so it's always there. Except the simplest ones, like, say, one-way analysis of variance. One-way analysis of variance, you don't need equal n's. But everything else, you pretty much do. Okay, so you need equal cell sizes. So let's say you have unequal n's. Then what? Because it's going to happen. And, I mean, you guys, again, I just talked about thesis conference, and you guys that go to it this year, you'll see that people have unequal n's. And you, next year, you'll be collecting data, a lot of you, and you'll have unequal cell sizes. And you'll wonder, what do I do? Well, there's a couple of things you could do. You could estimate the missing values. We talked briefly, no, that was in the lab class. One thing you could do is estimate the missing values. How would you do that? You could use the average, right? You could use the average of that group. You could use the overall grand mean. There's a lot of things you could do. The median, perhaps, depending on how this thing's distributed. Things to remember, though, when you do that, and then you crunch it through SPSS or Statistica, whatever the heck you're using, it's going to work under the assumption that that wasn't something that you estimated. It's going to work under the assumption that that's something that you actually got, so you have to adjust your degrees of freedom accordingly because you assigned the value arbitrarily. So you lose a degree of freedom when you do this. Just keep that in mind. One of the questions you can ask yourself is, when I'm going to make up the number, because that's what you're doing. If you're estimating a value, you're making up a number. Do you include the possibility of an interaction or not? Do you include the main effects? What do you do? So you could just estimate it, but you could come up with some kind of, you could say, okay, what's the main effects of A, what's the main effect of B, and what's the interaction, and put them in there. Do you assume, well, what if your analysis, before doing the estimation, what if it shows no interaction, statistically significant-wise, do you put that in? What if it shows no actual B effect, do you put that in? Those are real, now you think about it, this is actually a lot harder than just putting in a number. Or it's potentially a lot harder than just putting it in there. So remember, no matter what, you've lost the degree of freedom when you do this because you have arbitrarily assigned a value, an extra value. So it's something to keep in mind. Now, again, if you using almost any modern statistical software, you can tell it to put missing values in. And you can tell it how to do it, and it will actually correct for you. However, if you are putting the values in yourself, remember to remove that degree of freedom. Now, there are other ways to deal with this. Everything I've taught you so far, everything in the book, are what are called type 1 sums of squares. Okay? These are the ones that Fisher came up, Fisher and Yates, basically, determined. These were the type 1 sums of squares. They actually work perfectly if the n's are equal. And again, note the number of times when you looked at those things and it just said n. It didn't say n for one group, n for another. It just said n, assuming that all the number of subjects were equal. So it obviously, type 1 sums of squares assume equal n's. They don't work as well when you have unequal n's. And now you're wondering, oh, tomorrow at the Honors Thesis Conference, I'm going to see a bunch of talks where people had unequal n's and maybe they did it wrong. No, they didn't. There is something called type 2 sums of squares. I'm not going to show you how to calculate these things. They involve a great deal of matrix algebra. I don't like matrix algebra. I almost quit graduate school, I think, because of matrix algebra. It felt like it anyway, looking back. What type 2 sums of squares do is they deal with missing values. They deal with unequal n sizes. But they don't work when there's an interaction. Okay? They don't work when there's an interaction. So if you know there's no interaction, type 2s are fine. But of course, there's type 3 sums of squares. The nice thing about type 3s is that they deal with interactions. You may or may not know. You probably don't know if there's an interaction. How could you know? Type 3 sums of squares are safe. They work if there's an interaction, made of facts, or none of the above. Well, we've learned the type 1 analysis. I've told you about it because it's conceptually a lot easier to deal with. The software always uses type 3 sums of squares. So whenever you're using SPSS, or if you were using some other statistics package, it always used type 3 sums of squares. And again, that's all done with matrix algebra. Okay? If the n's are equal, by the way, type 1 equals type 2 equals type 3. Aha! So, if the n's are equal, it doesn't matter what kind you use. And that's why I always tell my honors thesis students, just go get another one. Go just test one more person. You know, it'll be fine. Makes life a little bit easier. It's also easier to do post hoc tests using, like, by hand, which I think is a much more sensible way to do things. It's a lot easier to do them like that if you do them with equal n's. And you look like a question.
I was just going to ask if the n's are equal in type 1, type 2, and type 3 are equal, isn't that like saying variance 1, variance 2, and variance 3 is equal?
No. Not at all. Because there are three different ways to calculate. There are three ways to estimate the same thing. So type 1, the expected value, let's make it for a very straightforward analysis of variance, like a 2 by 2. So what mean squared A, the expected value of that, if this is a 2 by 2, let's say, like a 2 factor, the expected value of that is alpha plus epsilon, assuming fixed factors, etc. Now, if the n's are equal, this is true. If the n's aren't equal, and we calculate mean squared A using type 1 sum of squares, that suddenly isn't true anymore. It screws with it a bit. Now, if there's no interaction, we have unequal n's, this is still true. If there is an interaction, and we have unequal n's, that's still true. If we have equal n's, which equals the type 1 sum of squares, which equals the type 2 sums of squares, which equals the type 3 sums of squares. Okay? So the point is that type 3's work always. So that's why we always use type 3 sums of squares in our calculations. In the computer, doing the calculations by hand. Anybody here love matrix algebra?
I don't even like plain algebra.
Yeah, so I mean, matrix algebra can be very hard. And frankly, you're not typically taught this stuff until you're in graduate school. And I was taught it in my PhD1 stats class. Because basically, it can make your brain explode. Unless you're like a math major and you've done a lot of matrix algebra, most people haven't really even dealt with it. Have you ever even done matrix algebra?
Never heard of it.
Yeah. Besides heard of it. But I mean matrix algebra. So if I had like something that looked like this. Was that equal? You don't even recognize what that means, right? I mean, it's hard. I think I actually could do that. But that's about as far as I go. I probably get that wrong, though.
Don't you just multiply each number from each section? Like 2 times 0 times 1 times 5?
No, that's the thing. It's not quite that easy. And then we can make it hard. That's hard to do. And that's actually simple. If there was a math major in the class, they'd go, well, I can do that. Well, yeah, fine, way to go, you're great. But mythical math major person. Screw you. Point is, we don't teach this because, frankly, unless you're, you know, if we had, if you did like a mathematical stats class, which I don't think we have one, if we did one, you'd learn that stuff, but that's not what we're using statistics for. So the reason I talk about showing you the type 1 sum of squares is intuitively it's pleasing, right? It's x minus, you know, say x bar for each root minus the grand mean square. They're just sums of squares, it makes sense. So the point is, though, that if the ends are equal, this crazy stuff with matrix algebra equals that nice intuitive thing with the summation sign and the little squared sign. So you don't have to worry about this too much if you do these things, but with a computer, which you typically do. Now, there's type 4 sums of squares. What? Why would you have those? We already have three types, and you said type 3 worked fine. Type 4 sums of squares work with empty cells. Now, an empty cell is when you literally are missing all the data in, like, A1, let's say, all your data for A2, B2, you don't have any.
Why wouldn't you have data?
Because you're a loser. As my old stats prof Ian used to say, the best way to collect unbalanced data is not to collect it! To analyze it, rather. Just don't collect data like this. There are times maybe you run out of money. Maybe it's impossible to do those two groups. It is conceivable this could happen. But don't let this happen. If you get a case where you have, well, I'll show in a second. The problem with empty cells is actually there's no unique solution. Because how do we know what goes in there? And type 4 sum of squares don't come up with a unique solution. The first time you calculate them, they come out one way. Then if you put the numbers in a different order, they come out a different way. It's significant now, but now it's not. Depending on the order you put the numbers in, you start doing the calculation.
So in other words, if you have data like that, you don't really have results.
Well, there's, like, think about this. A classic case is an empty cell. This is a 2x2. A1, A2, B1, B2. What goes here? What do you think? What looks sensible? Yeah, 4 looks sensible, doesn't it? For a sense of symmetry. Why not 703? Because you can't give me a better. It looks nice too. I mean, you can't say there is no unique solution to this. So type 4 sum of squares do something, but they're almost just there for theoretical interest. They're pretty much useless. What I would do in this case, if I couldn't collect this, is I would turn this into group 1, group 2, group 3, and I would do a one-way analysis of variance. I'm sorry, I can't do any interactions. I can't do mean effects of A or B. I can tell you the three groups are different. That's what I do here. The only thing I could do. So, you could make all kinds of things like 4 and 2 is 6, okay, 2 and 4 is 6. Yeah, that adds up nicely and it looks all nice and symmetrical. But maybe there shouldn't be an interaction. Right? Maybe theoretically you think to yourself there shouldn't be an interaction here, so we should work out a number here that gives us no interaction. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be intuitively logical to go, well, if B1A1 was 4 and then B1A2 was 2, there was a decrease in treatment, so maybe B2,
yeah, but you're,
A2
remember,
is...
the assumptions you're making are based on not enough information, right? Because you know going from B1, from A1 to A2 drops you 2. You could also say that, oh look. So I can make an argument. You can make arguments every which way. So going from A1 to A2 should drop you 2. Why shouldn't this be 0? Ooh, I see. So, I mean, you could say that too.
But isn't zero value better than nothing?
No, because it's now you're doing calculations based on numbers that are completely made up. That have you have no. You're every time you're doing it, you're making all kinds of extra assumptions. So if you and again, we can say that this should drop by 2. Fine, 0. This should be 4 because it looks like we have an interaction here. How do you know there's an interaction? I don't know. I can't know because I don't have all the information. Right. So almost anything you could make an argument for. And like I said, why not 726? Who knows? Maybe this is kind of crazy interaction where you get A2 and B2 together and it goes up to 726. There's no answer. So the best way to deal with this is just not to collect data on this. It really is. So that was quick. No, it's a quick talk. All right. Questions about that stuff? I wouldn't worry too much about it. It's just a nice way to round stuff out. No more analysis of variance. Yes. So it was done. So let's move on. Correlation, simple regression. This is how many of you guys, most of you guys took stats from Twain, most of you did. How many of you did you guys learn about correlation? Okay, so not everybody didn't learn about correlations. Okay.
We did correlations.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some correlations.
Yeah, but not regression? Not simple regression? That's okay. I think I told him to, if he's going to skip anything, skip simple regression. It's conception at that point. So some of this will be reviewish. Okay. All the procedures we've dealt with so far have looked at differences between means. Okay. That's what we look at. So you get like four groups and you see if the means are different. You know, it's that kind of thing. You can also look at the ratio. Yeah, you can also look at this as the relationship between an independent variable and a dependent variable. Right? So not are the groups different, but as the independent variable changes, does the dependent variable change? Right? That's kind of saying the same thing. So there's nothing wrong with doing that. Totally sensible. It's especially sensible with a continuous variable. It's actually pretty easy to see. So we tend to think of groups, group 1, group 2, group 3, and then does it change? That's one thing. You'll see those tomorrow in the honors thesis talks. People will have bar graphs that look great. But what if you have a variable that's continuous, where you can have a whole bunch of different, or not even continuous, but one that has a whole bunch of values, not just, say, 3. So think about this. This is going to be some made-up data about IQ and income. The relationship isn't nearly that tight, unfortunately. So here's some IQ scores, and here's some income in hundreds of thousands of dollars. Okay? It's actually pretty, the correlation there is about 0.5, so it's actually, that's not a 0.5 correlation, that's about 0.9 by the looks of that, but it's about 0.5 IQ and income. Okay, so that's a case where we have measured people's IQ, asked them how much money they make, and we just plot it up in the scatter plot, right? Pretty simple to do. The scatter plot, of course, is a useful exploratory data analysis technique. It's something that, if you have a lot of values, a scatter plot is a great thing in EDA. Very useful. But it'd be nice if we could somehow standardize the variable relationships, even if they have different scales. And frankly, look at IQ is measured in IQ points, and we're measuring income in dollars. Canadian dollars. Or euros, I care about. Shouldn't matter. We'd like to be able to standardize this. Right? We always want to make it so we can say no matter what, your height in inches or your height in centimeters, your weight in kilos or your weight in pounds, we should be able to get a number that says this is the correlation between weight and height. Or this is the correlation of IQ and income. Okay. So part of the way to start this is to look at how much these two variables, how much variance they share. In the next, for the remainder of the course, you're going to have to start thinking of variance as a thing. Okay, variance, and I know it's an odd thing to think of variance actually being something you can touch, but you have to start thinking of variance as a thing. And it's a little odd, But if two things vary, they can share variance. And that's what covariance is going to mean. Covariance is an interesting, if you look at this, it's got some intuitive appeal. The covariance of x and y, so we have values for x and values for y for a whole bunch of subjects. We take x, the x score, minus the average x, multiply it times their y score times the average y. And then we do that again and again and again for every single subject, and we divide by the number of observations minus 1. That should actually look a great deal like, think about this, it's the same as x minus x bar squared, except that we have two variables now, we have x and y. This measures the degree to which two variables vary together, how much they co-vary. This says, this shows how much if one goes up, the other one goes up, or how much if one goes up, the other one goes down. You should also note that unlike regular variance, this can be negative. Because think about this. If as x goes up, y goes down, typically, this is going to be a positive number, and this is going to be a negative number. A positive times a negative is a negative. So covariance can't be below zero. It's not a squared value, unlike regular variance. So if the deviations from x bar and y bar go in the same direction, you get positive covariation, or positive covariance. If the deviations go in the opposite direction, you get negative. Do you see why that's the case by looking at that formula? If as one goes up, the other one goes down, we get a negative covariance. If they both go, as one goes up, the other one goes up, or as one goes down, the other one goes down, we're always going to get a positive covariance.
Even if they both go down, it's still a positive covariance.
Yeah, because negative times negative would be positive, right?
Because they're both going together.
That's right.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Make sense?
Do they ever intersect?
I don't understand the question. What do you mean?
Like, will x or y ever interact? Like, if you were to graph it, would they ever cross each other?
When you graph it, we're talking about a scatter plot.
Right.
Okay? So, if they...
I guess I'm looking at it, maybe it's a factorial.
No, don't think of it that way. You can't think of it that way because it's not right. Well, you can, but it'd be wrong. So, think about as things bunch together, the more bunched together the scatter plot is, the higher this value will be. And think about the absurd example where we're measuring two things using two different scales. Measuring the same thing, I'm sorry, using two different scales. Let's say we're measuring your height in inches and your height in centimeters. If we were to draw a line or do a scatter plot, we'd get this. We'd get a straight line, right? If we had height in inches and height in centimeters. And the value for this, right, would be positive. Right? And in fact, yeah, it'd be positive. And in fact, they completely share all their variance in this case. Whereas if we had your height in centimeters and, well, it's hard to find something where there's no relationship at all.
The color of your hair?
How are you going to put color of hair into numbers?
Good point.
Yeah. And in fact, that wouldn't work. Because we have, if you took about like all humans, there are people that live in Somalia that are on average about 6'10", and they have black hair. They all do. Right? So, it's so hard to find anything. There's no relationship. The number of teeth you have as an adult and
sex?
Sex, that's still no good. Male, female, it's not good.
What about weight?
We could probably go with weight there, though. One could make the guess that people with really low weights have dental problems, and people with really high weights do because they eat so much that they brush their teeth.
I was thinking height and weight.
Height and weight, they correlate beautifully. Right? They're beautiful. Finding things that don't have any relationship, the number of feet you have and how fast you can run 100 meters, it's probably very low. I bet there's still a relationship.
Yeah, because like you said.
Because people with no teeth probably don't run very well. As a rule.
Because they probably have gingivitis, which leads to...
Which means they have another problem. It's so hard to find two variables that don't relate at all. Right? It's almost impossible, actually, because you can almost always think, oh, wait a second. Anyway, let's pretend we found something. It will be zero. No overlap. So you got to think about variance. Excuse me. Here's the variance in X. Here's the variance in Y. If they don't overlap at all, we get zero. There's no covariation. We're looking at degree of overlap.
And so if there's no covariation, that means there's no relationship.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. The thing is, we don't just want to measure how much variance they share. We want to measure the association between the two variables. And we're partway there. We have to standardize covariance so that the scales don't matter. So if we measured in height in centimeters, or height in inches, and we're doing weight, we don't want that to matter. So we have to standardize the scales. Covariance depends on the standard deviation of X and standard deviation of Y. Because it's about variance. It must depend on the standard deviation of X and the standard deviation of Y. If there's no variance in something, you get no relationship. Right? If there's no variance at all in something, you can get no relationship. So it's going to depend on S sub X and S sub Y. Well, if it depends on that, why don't we just divide by that? That's what we tend to do, right? Oh, this depends on this. That's what the thing about how we standardize, make standard scores, make Z scores. We say, oh, this depends on the standard deviation. So divide by standard deviation. That's what we do. So we just divide by S sub X and S sub Y like this to get what's called the Pearson correlation. So R equals the covariance of X and Y, calculated, divided by the standard deviation of X times the standard deviation of Y. Okay. That's, if you were taught about this, you were taught a very complicated formula with summation signs in it and stuff like that. If you break that down, all it's doing is doing covariation of X and Y divided by S of X times S of Y. If the absolute value of the covariance of X and Y equals the standard deviation of X times standard deviation of Y, then the absolute value of R equals 1.
You have?
It says have? And then you have a perfect relationship. If you put an accent on there somewhere, it looked like it's a name from Estonia.
Where?
Estonia, or Finland, or places like that. We use a lot of A's in a row. Finland's here. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Nobody? Does no one know geography?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay, good.
I know where Finland is, just not Estonia.
Yeah, it's
right underneath.
Right underneath, yeah.
Right across the ditch.
I'm
Finnish. Only two countries that in the world have similar languages from that category, the Finno-Ugric languages.
Though Hungarian seems to be related to it somewhat as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's just making these little
similar. But it's a different category.
Yeah.
It's in the same.
It's crazy.
It can be a very harsh language. Like if you're saying I love you to somebody in Finland, it's Minä rakastan sinua.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. They like to say their R's.
Yeah, they love their R's. They're rolling.
I don't think the R's in Finland is why can they produce. I get the hockey players. I get why they produce a lot of hockey players. It's cold there, it's ice. Why are there so many good, like, race car drivers from Finland?
Because they go over to Germany and drive on the off.
No, people, the thing is, people who do that from other countries, Sweden's a much bigger country than Finland. There's no, I can't think of a single Formula One driver from Sweden. But I could name you probably five Finnish F1 drivers.
Good at going fast and directing yourselves? I don't know. They've got really
it just seems strange to me that in Finland. I'd like to know why it's the case, you know. There's a racer, in fact, a guy that's an Italian who's even got a Finnish name because his parents were such big race car fans. Jarno Trulli. Jarno Trulli is not Finnish at all. He's Italian, is the most Italian person you've ever met, but his first name is Jarno. You know, it's really weird. Kimi Raikkonen, K.K. Rosberg, Mika Hakkinen. Goes on and on and on. Anyway. It should be half, not half. They have to go. So yeah, because well, the hell did I get there? So basically, if these two things are exactly the same, R is going to be one. Now the nice thing is because covariance is a sign, positive or negative, this will tell us the direction. So if as one goes up, the other one goes up, this is going to be a positive value. R is going to be positive. If as one goes up, the other one goes down, covariance is going to be negative. That's going to give us a negative value. Right? Make sense? So this is why the sign of a correlation, all that tells you about is the direction. Up, positive slope or negative slope. And also, this should tell you why, frankly, it could never be greater than one. It can't be. How could the covariance be any bigger than the product of the two standard deviations? Look at the formula. It basically is this. Right. You can see why it's called technically called the Pearson product moment correlation coefficient, because you have the product of the standard deviation of x times the product of the times of standard deviation of y. Nobody ever calls it that. They call it the Pearson R, just R. So R can only go between negative 1 and positive 1. And the negative, like a negative 0.7, is a bigger correlation than positive 0.4. One of my favorite sort of stat, whenever I've taught 2126 quiz questions is, Kenny has calculated some correlations. He got the following values. Negative 0.7, positive 0.4, 1.25, which one's the biggest? And it's negative 0.7. Because 1.25 is impossible, so Kenny made a mistake. And negative 0.7 is bigger than positive 0.4. It's just a negative correlation.
I think I remember this stuff now from 2126.
Yeah. I'm sure Dwayne didn't teach you this.
No, but he taught us about positive and negative correlation.
Yeah, of course.
Just the way you were talking about the quiz reminded me of it.
Okay, because he probably used my old quizzes. Does he even have the word Kenny? Because I always use the name Kenny.
I don't know if it was the exact same wording, but now I remember having to pick out which was larger. Yeah. And
that's a standard question. Even if he didn't use my quiz, it would be something he would have made up on his own.
Didn't you have a quiz that's all you had was a bunch of numbers, which one's bigger, which one's smaller, and you reached a point the first time or something?
I don't know.
It's been a while.
It was like define statistics in your own words, and every time you'd be like, "I said in your own words." Every time.
Yeah. I remember that.
All right. So straight lines only. Remember that. It's only straight lines. What's so funny? Jamal's always having a good time.
You said,
alright. Okay. Alright. Good enough. I'm going to miss when you graduate, because you laugh at almost everything I say. I'm just disturbed that I think you're laughing at me and not with me. But the point is, you can't have this.
You can't have like
each one. Okay. So if you got this. Okay, dose response curve for a drug, which are often beautiful parabolas. I'm sorry, not parabolas. That would give you correlation of zero. Okay. Because look, why would that be? You'd say that's a beautiful relationship. Sure. But as one goes up, the other one goes up for a while. Then as one goes up, it doesn't change. Then as one goes down, the other one goes down. It's going to be covariance of zero. sadly. This is why doing a scatterplot's important, because there are variables that relate like this. Like, so, I said, drugs and things like that. Yep.
So if you see that, you automatically know that there is no covariance.
There is covariance. You just count. This is a linear covariance. You have to do it using a different set. It's conceptually exactly the same. The calculations are different. Yeah. There's a way to do this. Is called curvilinear correlation. You can do it. It's actually not very difficult. The point is, the only problem with it is you have to know the shape
before you do that.
Yeah, so you do a scatter plot and then say that's a parabola, and then you have to guess what the equation of the parabola is. That's not that hard to do.
It sounds hard.
No, you'd be surprised how easy that is. It's harder when it's a relationship that looks like this, like a polynomial. That's hard. For me, that's hard. This, it's a parabola, and it's the origins here. Oh, I can figure out what that is. Straight lines. Good. Curves back. You know, that's the... You know what would be really cool? It'd be cool if we could predict y from x. This would have tremendous value. Because we can say, what's your score in x? Well, here's what your score should be in y. And you must know that this is possible for two reasons. I wouldn't have a slide with that title, and then would stop here. Secondly, you've all been to a doctor in your life, and especially when you're younger... And especially if you've got kids, or been around kids, and they take their height, and the doctor looks on a chart and says, the weight should be right about there. Oh, that's right about right. Your kid's fine. Or they look again, they go, your kid's too thin. Give him milkshakes. Or your kid should have fewer milkshakes. So, I love milkshakes. I get these cravings.
We make them pretty good at Bobber's, just don't come when I'm working because I hate making them.
You hate making milkshakes?
I hate making them. We have a really old machine and it tends to explode.
When my dad was alive, well, yeah, of course, when he was alive, because when he was dead, he didn't have a milkshake making machine. my mom had it at that point. But my dad had this a classic milkshake making machine because that's the kind of guy he was, and it was awesome. It was great. Anyway, doctor looks and says, look, you're right and they're right. I predict your height from your weight. That's what the doctors do. And most doctors don't even know how they did it because they just have a chart, which is fine. They don't have to know how to do it. Some poor bastard has to do that for them. So basically just drawing a line through a scatter plot, in fact. So if we had a scatter plot, we just make up a little scatter plot here. I was enjoying doing this because I get to do this. Jiggy with it. So, we now have a scatter plot. Now, what we want to do is draw a line through this so we can predict y from x. Right? That's what we want to do. Because, and the thing is, I think I can do that. And you probably look at that and go, that's pretty good. That's not a bad line. To that one. This one. That one. How do we choose which one? Now, there are some, if you just connect all the dots, that would be good, right? You say, well, that's great, Dave, but you have to actually collect the data before you make the prediction. That's not a real prediction. But you can draw a number of straight lines. The question is, how do you pick which one? Now, what people tend to do is they do what's called the least squares regression one. What you want to do is minimize prediction error. You're going to make mistakes. Now look, the real data are these dots here. That was horrible, man. And the distance between the dot and the line, that's a mistake. That's a prediction error. That's not the data are wrong, that's your line's wrong. Because your line got it wrong. It's either too high or too low. Right? So you've made a mistake. What we want to do is we want to minimize those values. And if there's going to be positives and negatives, how do we get rid of negatives? We square them. So we want to get the line that has the smallest sums of squares, sum of squared deviations from that line. So, looks like that. Except these points should be over here. It's because of the damn projector. So this point, pretend it's here. That's a prediction error. This point, pretend it's here. That's a prediction error. This point is actually where it belongs. That's a prediction error. This point is supposed to be here. That's your prediction error. Here's your line. Okay? So these are actual y values. Now this is pointing to the right place. I don't know what's going on with this. This is called... It's got a strange name. It's called Y hat. Because it's got a hat on it. And I kid you not. It's not like Y circumflex. Because that's a circumflex accent, you know? I always want to, I keep forgetting, I want to ask, I got a friend who teaches stats at the Little Brunswick Admin Center. I always want to ask him, in French, do you say Y chapeau? Or do you say Y circumflex? Because I kind of hope it's chapeau. You know, I doubt it is, but I kind of hope it is.
Ask Ella.
Ask
Ella.
It's probably
Ella. Ask who?
Our French exchange student.
Alex would know.
Yes,
outstanding. We will ask Alex. It'll finally be figured out. Unless he has enough stats yet to do this.
He still might know.
Yeah, he might. It's a good, you know, I will ask Alex. Go ask Alex.
If you show it to him, you need to have the words.
Oh, no, it would be either Y, is Y and circumflex is the accent. So, you know. But I want it to be shuffled. Or beret. Casque, you know, helmet. Why helmet's even better? I want an Y casque.
Wouldn't your wife
know, too? No, she didn't do any statistics. No, she went to a market research company, but she didn't do any of this. She ran focus groups, things like that. Yeah. She would call it Y circumflex, I'm sure. And then she'd tell you that you're not supposed to put a circumflex over a Y. And she'd be right, you know, because that doesn't belong. So, you got Y hat, that's your prediction, and you got Y, those are the actual values. You want to minimize the Y hat minus Y. Okay? So we're going to minimize the sum of Y minus Y hat squared. Now, those of you that took math and remember any of it, so none of you, realize that actually doing a minimum and a maximum is actually a pretty easy thing to do. And I know you did it in grade 9. Because I know I did it in grade 9. And there's no way that math suddenly got easier. You know, I didn't go to some fancy school or anything either. I just went to high school. I didn't go to some special school for people that like statistics or something like that. Right, so a standard part of the grade 9 curriculum was calculating minima and maxima. It's not, it's something you have done.
Like you said, though, I don't
remember. No, you don't have to remember it. The point is that it's something that mathematically isn't a hard thing to do. So look at that and go, that's kind of hard to do, because what do? You have to find every possible line and then see which one has the lowest sum of squares? No, actually, mathematically, it's an easy thing to do. So the math behind this actually is pretty simple. Getting a minimum. So what you end up with is a prediction equation. Y hat equals A plus BX. So that's your predicted Y equals the slope. That just says text. It shouldn't say that. Equals, sorry, that can't be this. That's wrong. That should say intercept. A is the intercept. B is the slope. Yeah, B is the slope. Fix that. Yeah, now, so A is the intercept, B is the slope. That's wrong. A, intercept, B, slope. Now, here's something that you probably were told in school. Remember this? Now you're going to look at this and I remember that.
Equals MX plus B.
Yeah, well, not in statistics. The B goes where the M is and there's no M, it's an A. So, I know we're taught Y equals MX plus B, and B is the intercept at M, is the slope, but now B is the slope and A is the intercept. I wish everybody just get together and we could all get along and use the same notation, but it doesn't work that way.
What does the y hat equal again? Sorry,
I can't see. Predicted what?
Oh,
yeah.
So then it's a good thing I don't remember that.
Yes, because that might mess you up. Yep. So y hat equals a plus dx. A is the intercept. That's where x equals 0. That's where it hits the axis. And b is the slope. Okay? High positive slope, no slope, negative slope.
So what does, if B on its own is the slope, what's the X?
The X is the value of X.
Okay.
So we're predicting, let's say, height from your value and weight. So we get whatever A is, it's a constant, same for everybody, plus some number times your weight. So your height, when I say height from weight, away from height, let's say we're predicting weight from height. So your weight equals some value plus some other value times your height. Okay, which is exactly what's done in the doctor's office when they look at that chart. They don't have the equation in front of them.
So they typically have a range in that chart.
Yeah, because there's going to be basically where 95% of people are. Yeah.
Okay.
Or some percentage. I mean, it depends on what they're using, what the flavor of the week is, on what OBs means.
Yeah.
You know.
So A is the slope or B is the
slope? No, B is the slope. A is the intercept, that's wrong. I have to fix that.
And X was what, the value of
X? X is just a value. The value, just a value of X. It's a variable. Right? There's X, there's Y.
So no matter what it is the value that you have at hand?
Yeah, yeah, because you're predicting Y from X. So if I know your X, I can guess your Y. If I know your height, I can guess your weight. Right. If I know your IQ, I can guess your income. Right.
So if you know my income, can you guess my IQ?
Yeah, because it goes exactly the opposite way. Yeah. Within, again, this is going to be prediction error, right? It's a guess.
Unless you're a student.
No, I would see, then we'll talk about that. That's a good point. But, I mean, for example, our contract at the university, our collective agreement for professors, there's a floor for each rank. That's A. Times the number of years you've been at that rank. Times a certain amount of money. So there's a floor. Right? This is all publicly available, by the way. You can go look it up and figure out how much money you'll make. It's lots of fun. So, I'm an associate professor, okay? So, I don't actually know what the floor is for associate, but let's make a number up. Let's say it's, I don't know how much money I make, but I don't know what the floor is, because I'm not at the floor. Let's say it's $85,000 a year, okay? So it's 85 plus how many years the person's been at the rank, say 10, times, say, $2,500 a year. So that means that someone who was an associate professor 10 years makes $105,000 a year. Right? Because it was 80,000. Was it 80,000?
85.
I said 85? Okay. Well, that still worked out. Yeah, 85,000 plus 10 times 2,500. No, I mean 110,000. Right? That's just that kind of thing. So one is where you start out at. Everybody starts there if they're at that rank. Plus some number. The slope, $2,500, times the number of years in this case, then you can exact. In this case, in fact, you can actually completely, accurately, and totally predict someone's salary.
Okay, so if you were starting out in a job and you knew you were going to get an increase of like $100 a year, so just some made up thing, you could predict what you'd be making 25 years from that.
Yes, of course, assuming that same contract's in place, which it wouldn't be. But yeah.
That's kind of neat.
Yeah. So that's actually roughly, those numbers I gave you actually roughly true for here, for that, right? Yeah.
So would you consider the intercept like the baseline of some experiment?
It's more like a brand mean, so there's a better way to think of it. It's kind of, in an algebra, it's the same kind of idea. Everybody starts there, then you go up or down, depending on your score times some constant. That's the slope.
So is this how they predict like height? For children?
Yeah.
Like what they're going to know? Okay.
Yeah. It's all, this is a simple regression.
They did it wrong on...
Well, no, because then there's going to be prediction errors.
There's going to be...
With prediction errors. Like, with our union agreement, there aren't any errors. At least it's not supposed to be. So you should be able to exactly predict how much money you make. One of the first things, maybe we just finally, even though our contract goes back along, it was figured out back in like January, they finally started paying us at the level that we're supposed to be paid at, just this last paycheck. Okay? Yeah, we got ready for pay, it'll work out fine. But the point is, the first thing, I know, at least that I did, is I looked at my paycheck, I multiplied the number times 24, figured out what the number was, and went back and looked at the formula and said, oh good, they're paying me the right amount. Because they could make a mistake. Right? Which they did once in Newfoundland, they didn't pay me enough for 4 months, so they fixed it. And I was told to check it, because a friend of mine, they overpaid for a year. He had to pay it back.
Aww.
Well, it's, you know, it's only fair, it wasn't his money. Really.
Pissed when that happened. He's like, well, then why did you give it to me?
The thing is, he told them that every week for a year, and they wouldn't believe him.
He told them every week
for a year? Yeah, he kept saying, every 2 weeks, every paycheck, he'd say, you know, you're paying me too much. And they go, oh, yeah, we'll look into that. Never look into it. Finally, they looked into it. Well, you owe us $3,000. Okay, but...
Well,
my fault.
I bet he definitely said
that. Well, you know, he basically knew he was a careful enough guy that I think he was putting the money in a bank account and not touching it for so he could just pay it all back. So.
Hopefully it was a high-interest savings account.
So, if you wanted to find these, to calculate these, you can. B is calculated as the covariance of X and Y divided by the variance of X. That's how you calculate B. So your slope is calculated that way. Your intercept is Y bar minus B times X bar. I will never make you calculate this. It's not worth the effort.
But we'll need to know the formula.
Well, you have them right in front of you. You can do it. But I wouldn't ask you to do it. The point is that it's really a pretty simple calculation, but think about calculating covariance. It's a pain. Pairs of values. It's really, really, really a nightmare. So one could do this. No one does. When I was an undergrad in a class like this, we did have to do these by hand just for simple regressions where you can swap batches of numbers, and it was a nightmare. It would take you 45 minutes to do one question. It's not really worth it. I'm working on this stuff so you guys don't need calculators. The important thing is interpreting this stuff. We have to be able to interpret this. Where x equals 0, it's not always that meaningful. Now, in the case of trying to calculate your salary with our union agreement, that is useful. Because it says that's the floor, that's the base that everyone gets. And then we add on what we call PPRs, progression through the ranks, steps for each year. So that's fine. But is it always sensible to talk about the intercept? Well, let's say you're predicting height from weight. Well, what would someone weigh if they had zero height?
Zero.
Yeah, well, they would, of course, but the equation wouldn't show that. Right?
What?
The equation wouldn't show that. It wouldn't work out. Because we wouldn't have very many values that are so low. So it wouldn't work out that way. There'd be like a base amount. So that's no good. Or what about... What if we were looking at correlating the number of cigarettes you smoke a day and your life expectancy? So that'd be negative. First, it would be a negative correlation. We know that. Because the more smoke you smoke, the shorter you live. That's how it works. Cigarettes, when used as directed, they kill. So we get that. But, so let's say you smoke... There's probably some small, hardly significant effect of smoking 2 or 3 cigarettes a day. I'm sure there is. It's probably negligible, but I'm sure it exists. Do we want to have on the same line, want to use the same equation when someone has smoked 0 cigarettes per day? That's a different population. Those are called non-smokers. Right? What if we looked at how old you are No, that's the next example, so let's forget that for a second. But do you see why zero isn't always meaningful? In fact, it almost always isn't meaningful. It's basically like the grand mean. It's a constant that then you add everybody's value for x times the slope onto. Remember, it's only linear relationships, so only straight lines. This can be done with curves, right? It can be done with curves. It's done still with the least squares regression. So it's the amount of, you minimize y minus y hat squared. You still do that, but you have to know that now this is not the equation. It's not going to be y equals nx plus b. It's, y equals a plus b, actually. It might be this. So you have to figure out, is it that's a parabola, x squared. Right? See if you have to figure it that way. One of the ways, how do you detect if it's not a linear relationship? Well, obviously a scatter plot is going to help you here. But generally, one of the things you can do is look at what's called a residual plot. Now the residuals are E for error. Okay. All they are, it's these. That's the residual. Y minus y hat. That's what equals E. That's a tadpole. That's E. So if it's a linear relationship, we should get something that looks like this. If we get a scatter plot of the residuals with y. Now, if it's curvilinear somehow, we might get something, so it should look nice like this, we might get something that looks more like this. Now, you might say, why would you do this if you could just do a scatter plot? Because when we get to a case where we have more than one x variable, so we have, you're going to predict your height by your weight and your age, now we're getting much more complicated. And we're going to look at individual variables using what are called these residual plots. So one of the ways to do it was with this residual plot, which is something any statistics software doing regression, you can just select residual plots and it'll give them to you. The covariance of x and e, residual, should be zero. And same with the covariance of y and e. We tend to use x. So you got to make sure it's a linear relationship only. Don't go outside the range when you're making. Don't go outside the range of prediction. Oh, sorry. If you're making prediction, don't go outside the range of where you collect the data. So, if we said that, like, if we collected data like how many sex partners people have based on their age, if we were going to predict that, we're going to get a positive correlation because the older you are, the more likely you are to have slept with somebody. And it's more likely to be more than one person the older you get. It's just, you know, that's just the way things work. You run into more people. Yeah, you meet more people, and sometimes you have sex with them. This is what happens, right? Really, that's what I was told. It's the way of the world, exactly. It's the way things work. So, fair enough. Now, if you're collecting those data, you might start with, say, people who are 14. Right? Okay. And you might go up to people there, well, let's see, most people die around 75. So let's stop around 70. So people between 14 and 70, we got their ages, that's an easy thing to measure, and then we ask them, how many people have you slept with? And they tell you. And we get a positive correlation, sure.
But you'd have to factor in, like, different things.
We're not going to factor in anything. We're going to predict number of sex partners by age.
So you're going to say that a 75-year-old woman who was born 75 years ago and has completely different moral standards,
yes,
than the 18-year-old,
yeah,
woman who was
on average. On average, yes.
You would say that the 75-year-old woman had more sexual partners than that 18-year-old woman,
well,
or even a 30-year-old.
It's an empirical question. No, it is. You would just do the thing. You'd probably be surprised how many times people had sex without telling anybody.
Wouldn't that be done through like a cross-sectional type of...
Yeah, let's not worry about that, guys. Just a second. This is 2127. So what we're going to do is we're going to measure how many sex partners you've had based on people the age of 14 and 7.
I'd say stop at 30, you might be.
Okay, fine. 14 and 30.
There we go.
Doesn't matter. The point is, if I said, let's say 14 and 30, that's great. And let's say it's your age times, let's say it starts, I don't know what the intercept would be, 0.5, and then we're going to add on 0.25 or point, let's say 0.125 per year or something like that.
One and a quarter people?
No, that's a guess. But what if you lived to be 305? Why? You'd be quite hot with the ladies. So, it doesn't make any sense to talk to people with 305. Or, let's go with your example. If we're going between ages of 14 and 30, and then we say, well, the average 30-year-old seems like they've had sex with, like, 5 people. Oh, and 60-year-olds, that's, let's be by my calculations, all live in the Playboy Mansion. And have had sex with 15 people, whatever the thing is. Or you go the other way. Well, that means then the 2-year-olds, if we put their nose, then you can't do that. Right? On a lot of levels. But, point is, you can't go, going outside the range is a problem. And people really, it's very tempting. It's very tempting when I give you a formula that says the number of sex partners you have equals whatever your baseline, you know, intercept is, plus some value times how old you are. It's so tempting to go, oh, what happened? Right? Because it looks, it's got that, what Stephen Colbert calls the air of truthiness, right? Because you look at it, it's an equation. Well, if it's an equation, I can just plug numbers in and get stuff out of it. Right? It's like height and weight. Well, let's see, what would it be if you were 14 feet tall? Why, you'd weigh, you know, whatever. You can't do that. So, going outside the range like that is potentially a problem. Right? Or if we did something like how old someone is and how many cigarettes they smoke a day. That'd be another. I'm using that because it's actually an example I'm going to use with cigarette smoking later because a friend of next week because a friend of mine did some really neat behavioral stuff on cigarette smoking, and it's a great example of regression. That's why I keep using that example.
How old you were when you started?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Okay.
But if we looked and saw among smokers how many years they've been smoking, and we were predicting that, sorry, how many cigarettes they smoke a day, and we're going to predict that with how many years they've been smoking, which you can do. We don't then take that and say, okay, let's see what it would be like if we had a 3-year-old smoker. It doesn't make any sense. You could put it in the formula, and then you get a number come out, but would it follow at all? Well, no, most 3-year-olds don't smoke. Right? There's that one kid on, one baby on YouTube you might have seen. Smoked, so a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
Please tell me whoever was doing the video, the parents were arrested.
Well, I don't know. It's in the Philippines or something. They have a whole different lifestyle over there. Certainly babies are smoking on the street. I don't think it's right there. Either. I do remember that. Remember that TV show called We're Killing Our Kids? Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where they'd show people that had bad eating habits. It's a British show.
It was an Australian one.
There's an Australian one too, but I think it's also an ITV show in Britain.
Oh, okay.
Because the woman will come on and say, "You're kidding them." And then they show the person, and they usually had horrible eating habits. Typically they would eat frozen food only and, you know, all prepackaged stuff. And then they'd use Photoshop, which they call computer technology, and show what the kids would look like aged.
Computer generation aged.
Yeah, and all it was just Photoshopping pictures, right?
Yeah.
And they show the, you know, with missing teeth and all this. And, you know, you always have people say,
"And wait,
that, don't know what it's like to cook from fresh." Things like that. They ask the kid, "What did you eat last night?" "Chips." You know, it's horrible. But then usually they make the parents do something too, and it's usually not just eating, it's also like lifestyle, doing exercise, things like that. And they'd often tell the parents, if they were, say, smokers, quit smoking, because that's something you should do as well. And they did that once, but they said that the woman, and this little kid, he's about 10, he's kind of a, I think he's a normal-looking 10-year-old, really, but didn't eat very well. Said the mother, and you have to quit smoking. You also must quit smoking. And the 10-year-old kid says, do I have to quit smoking too? Because he's been smoking since he was 4. And he had an ashtray in his room, which on some level is kind of badass. But it's also pretty horrible. And then that's the one example I can think of. Oh, yeah, okay, there are 4-year-olds that smoke. But typically, you wouldn't plug that into that equation. So you've got to keep that in mind. As tempting as it is when I give you an equation that says your height equals this times your weight. Right? It's like if they tell you, well, if you paid $10 an hour, you think to yourself, okay, so if I work 8 hours, so that's 80 times 5 days a week, that's 40. That's 400. Okay, so $400. That's okay. So $400 a week. And then you say, but if I worked 1,000 hours a day, you can't do that.
Yeah, because then people who weigh like the 500 pounds that are morbidly obese, they're not going to be like...
No, and there's that too. That's, remember, they're a different population.
Oh,
right? Just like using smokers and non-smokers, looking at a 3-year-old and saying, how much would you think this 3-year-old smokes? You can't do that because they're non-smokers. Or people aren't sexually active when they're 10, hopefully. That kind of thing. All right. Questions? Okay, we will talk about multiple regression, which is our final topic, next time. And I thank you. And I will see you tomorrow, hopefully most of you at this conference. And I'll see you again.
Sometimes it goes through our breath.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.